So we're continuing our voyage through the book of Romans. And we worked our way, Neil took us through the first part of Romans 5. And then we had a look at that thing about how in one man everybody fell, so in the one man Jesus everybody gets rescued. And so sin enters through one man, but life, resurrection life, comes through Jesus. In that back end of Romans 5. And we got this fabulous ending, this sort of big crescendo of what's going on in Romans 5, but where sin increased, grace increased all the more. So that just as sin reigned in death, even so, through God's faithful covenant justice, grace might reign in the life of the age to come through Jesus the Messiah our Lord. In other words, just as this world seems doomed through Adam's rebellion and our rebellion against God, so in Jesus, the eternal life of God invades this world, starts to remake this world, becomes a present reality here in what Paul calls the reign of grace. Isn't that something? And it's just so much of our living, and Paul recognizes this. You can read this in the back end of Galatians 3 running into Galatians 4. So much of our struggle is that we don't actually believe this. We don't live as if it's true. We don't lay hold of what's ours. So we've been working through Bible 101. And in Bible 101, we've had this fantastic introduction to the scriptures, and Andrew's taken us over the whole run of what the story of the scriptures says. And we were in the first sort of substantial week this week looking at creation. Now, what's in the Bible? Creation. But then there's the fall, and that enters in through Adam and Eve. And then there's Israel, which shows God's love. Then there's Jesus, which does something, fulfills that old covenant promise, and brings in that new covenant. And so we get the age of the church, the age of new creation. Those are the five acts of that great play. And you can see those playing out. You'll see them play out even as I'm sharing today. And that great move, that great big picture, is what Paul is thinking about here. So he's been talking about the reign of grace. This is the new thing. This is the wonderful thing that's broken into our reality here. Our mission statement as a church is to encourage everyone to live in the reality of Jesus' love. It's to lay hold of that grace for themselves so that they can run through the finishing tape ready. Because for all of us, our life here is temporary. We've said goodbye to many dear friends, and indeed in the last week we said goodbye to Gene Richardson. But we're only here a while. But it's not that we hang on until glory comes. It's not that we just kind of struggle our way through here until it's all fixed. Actually, by faith, what Paul's saying is that when we by faith trust in Jesus, something transforms here. I've been to the Midlothian Council Community Planning Partnership Day. Go across the end of the year, sort of, I think it's November time, is it? Across the Easter Bush. And that was a real eye-opener. People from all over the council, different agencies and stuff, all trying to figure out how best to plan for the future for Midlothian. And I was invited along because of the work we're doing with faith communities in the wider area, and also because obviously we have a role to play in emergency food provision for Midlothian. And it was really interesting seeing all the different priorities and policies being put in play. Folks who really care about good outcomes for people in Midlothian. But in truth, what I really want to say there is if we can just find a way to open a great sluice from heaven so that the grace of Jesus can pour into Midlothian, that's going to sort out many of our community problems. Or at least give us the resources to address them. Now, I can sort of say that in that setting, because I can say I'm a minister and obviously I bring that perspective. But when you understand what Paul is talking about here, it's that thing where this isn't just hope for after death. It's not a post-mortem jolly. You know, it's not your time-sharing glory booked. and you hold on till your flight leaves. This is much more about the transforming power of the resurrected Lord Jesus Christ to make Gorebridge and Bonnyrigg and Mayfield and East Houses and Pennycook and Danderhall, all of these areas, just full of His glory. Full of His glory. When I first came to Gorebridge, many of my conversations with people, especially with young people, were quite depressing. I was making my way in, and they'd say, "Can't I wait to get out? Can't I wait to get out?" And I'd say, "Really? Oh, can't I wait to get out? What are you doing here?" "Oh, I'm trusting God to do great things here." And you know what? I don't have some of your smiling because you've been in that situation. Some of you are smiling very big smiles because you said that years ago and God brought you back. I know, Elspeth, Willie, I'm talking to you. So those of you who said, "Right, that's it, I'm off, I'm never coming back." But that's changed. When I talk to young people now, I hardly ever hear that. In fact, according to some reports, there's loads of young people, and they're causing a bit of mayhem up the Hunterfield Road. And we're working with many of these young people too, so be nice to them. Even when you catch them doing what I caught one of them doing on Thursday, what can I say? Let's say he was tending the plants without a watering can. And the thing was, I told him off, and he was going, and his pal said, "We're really sorry, it's our first time here." I said, there's a loo in the hall. He says, "We didn't again." Bless. Then we had a discussion yesterday as to whether we should apply for funding to put an outside loo. Okay. But I don't hear that so much these days. Now, is it because the railways arrived? Is it because housing's been done? Is it because there's been some work done on the social and infrastructure of Gorebridge? Maybe. What do I think's happened? I think God's presence is tangible here. It's tangible. We're not there yet. Oh my goodness me, we're not there yet. That's to do with Gladys and Billy and Father Allen. It's to do with all the Christians who worship outside. It's to do with folks starting to trust God that, you know, we're not condemned to be here, but we're actually called to transform. So we're moving now into Romans chapter 6. By the way, my hope is that that will continue. I keep coming across ministers who said, I got to the point, I did everything that I could do in that church. And I do come across this, you know, we 5, 6, 7, 8 years. And I respect their point of view, but I just don't understand that. Because when is God ever finished with a place? When's He ever finished? Paul described it as being changed from glory into glory. It's kind of like, oh, this is amazing, but this is amazinger. And this, you never get to amazingest. Not here. So Paul's describing what happens when we transition out of that state of sin. And I can't emphasize this enough. This has got nothing to do with your death and winding up in heaven. This is to do with the point where we trust Jesus to change things here. So you can read this with me if you find that helps. If you don't worry. What are we to say then? Shall we continue in the state of sin so that grace may increase? Or as the NIV would put it, shall we sin all the more that grace may abound all the more? What do you think his answer is going to be for that? Certainly not. We died to sin. How can we still live in it? Don't you know that all of us who were baptized into the Messiah Jesus were baptized into his death? In other words, what Paul's describing here is that you're already dead. Okay? Poke your neighbor and say, "You look good for a zombie." Now. I'd give my right arm to be a zombie. I wouldn't have a leg to stand on. Oh, we're going to stop this. Right. Anyway, what Paul's describing there, you see, Here's the thing, is he's got this church in Rome, which has some Jewish Christians and some Gentile Christians, and a lot of the grenades they're lobbing at each other are nothing to do with Jesus. They're everything to do with their old life, their sinful life. And he's saying, look, guys, we don't stay in our old life just to make, you know, more grace come. That's not how it works. Do any of you here used to go into Paddy's? Because I can't imagine any of you here still going to Paddy's. Do you? You know the thing when everybody's at the party? Da, 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 young man. All right? And you're sitting in the corner. You ever do that? Okay. And then if that doesn't work, the little helicopter pad that is your bottom lip gets a bit wider. All right? You're in a Paddy. That's what Paul's describing here. Why would you stay in your old filthy life that Jesus died to put to death? Why would you stay there to get more grace? You know, come rescue me, come rescue me. When actually what he's asking you to do is to get over here where you're walking in the new life and you have the ability to call down the glory from heaven or the party, if you like. So instead of being a curmudgeon at a party you don't want to take part in, he's saying, you know, get more party. I don't know how you do that, but I'm sure they've got some in heaven. And heaven party is going to be good. So, that's what Paul's trying to describe there. Because many of our mindsets about the Christian life are sort of on the basis of this is really hard. Have you ever come across a Christian or you ever felt this yourself where you're keeping the rules and you resent the people who aren't? You're going, that's not me. Yes, you do. Yes, you do. You see somebody doing something wrong and you go, I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't do that. All right? Because we're always judgmental of people who sin differently for us when we're walking in that old life mindset. And what Paul's saying is that don't stay there. Remember, sin isn't so much about guilt. It's not getting on with God's will. You do understand that, don't you? One of my options for the kids' talk this morning was to give them a Nerf gun. You know, a Nerf gun is, as far as a little foam bullet. And really sin, the word for sin in Greek is a thing called hamartano. And hamartano just means missing the mark. It doesn't mean really guilty, you know, Miss Jean Brody waggy finger thing. It just means missing the mark. It means getting it wrong. You know, which if you're diving off a building or whatever, that can be really bad. But it's missing the mark. Just like an archer not hitting the target. And so the state of sin is the place where we are incapable of doing what pleases God regularly. Now, it doesn't mean we can't do it sometimes. It just means that our predication is to not be able to do it. And the state of grace is where we can start to do it. We don't do it perfectly, not in this life, but we can start to do it. We start to be able to do. We start to make those decisions, to make those choices, to love people, to love God, love people, and do stuff, as Bob Goff said, and Ross keeps reminding me. So that's what that's about. So certainly not, says Paul, we'll continue. We died to sin, how can we still live in it? Don't you know that all of us who are baptized into the Messiah Jesus were baptized into his death? And so in other words, as I say, when we do baptisms, it's a death. That means that we were buried with him through baptism into death, so that just as the Messiah, that's Jesus, was raised from the dead through the Father's glory, we too might behave with a new quality of life. For if we have been planted together in the likeness of his death, there you go, that's just to say planted is a ministerial term for burial. Okay, if we have been planted together in the likeness of his death, nobody sniggered. Was that too close to the bone? Oops. Right? We shall also be in the likeness of his resurrection. So let's explain this one. So what Paul's saying is that when we trust in Jesus, who has fulfilled the old covenant, what's true of Jesus becomes true of us. Okay? So it's like one of those films where someone handcuffs themselves to somebody else so They can't get away from them, except in a good way. When we trust in Jesus, what's true of Jesus becomes true for us. Because God has decided that in a world where we are free to do what we want, the indicator that we're serious about trusting Him is faith. It's trusting Him. Indeed, faith is a gift. So God is always ready to give us a gift of faith. It's just a matter of whether we're ready to receive it. So at the moment, there's faith transmission waves or whatever coming out of glory for you to hook up to, which is what we do in worship, by the way. And as that happens, then we start to get a hold of this for ourselves. This is why when we do a baptism, we talk about faith. Because the faith we have in Jesus is the means by which all the wonderful things that Jesus died and rose again to bring to us actually get to us in the first place. It's by faith. So when we have faith in Jesus, through our baptism, we're buried with Him. Okay, imagine those of you being to the beach meeting place. Okay, so there's Claymore, Kersplosh, and there's three of us ready. Bring him back up out. So he's been buried through baptism into death, so that just as the Messiah was raised from the dead, and Claymore's singing, hurry up, Mark, it's wet down here. Through the Father's glory, we too might behave with a new quality of life. Whoomph! He's got a brand new life. Now, has he got a brand new life because we dunked him in the North Sea? No. He's got a brand new life because he's put his faith in Jesus. It's not the baptism that gives this to Claymore. It is his faith in Jesus that gives this to Claymore, which is exercised through willingly allowing himself to be baptized. You with me? So it's not that the baptism doesn't work. It just doesn't work in that way. Are you with me? It's a bit like... So we're missing Andy. That's why I'm playing the Leckie guitar today. And we're missing Neil. Because both of them are in the same place. Can you guess? The Castle of Tyne. Where they are hoping that they shall overcome the people from Easter Road in a derby. Of course, there are people who prefer things in Easter Road, which frankly sounds more Christian to me, and they will overcome the team from Gorgie. And they're going to be there, maybe they've got a scarf or a t-shirt or something that indicates their dedication to their team, all right? Now, the scarf or the t-shirt isn't the dedication, is it? It's still important. It's an outward sign of an inward hopeless cause, but that's what it is, and it's the same with baptism. Baptism's just like a public declaration. It's like your scarf and your shirt and, you know, whatever. I've done enough with that. So there we go. So if we've been planted together in the likeness of his death, so we shall also be in the likeness of his resurrection. If by faith we've allowed that old life to be put to death, then boom, we've got a new life. That new life to live that's able to trust God for the transformation of this world, this community, the infilling of his church, the sending out of people to the highways and byways and workplaces and communities of this county so that they will know the love of Jesus for themselves. And then Paul goes on to say this, this is what we know. Our old humanity was crucified with the Messiah so that the solidarity of sin, the kind of togetherness of sin might be abolished and that we should no longer be enslaved to sin. A person who has died, you see, has been declared free from all charges of sin. Now, here's a tricky one. Who still behaves like their old life's still around? I do. I behave like my old life's still around. I pray lousy prayers from that place. It's kind of, oh, God, help me. Make that person go away. Make my children more obedient, you know. Where's the money? All those kind of lousy prayers. And it's because I'm feeling sorry for myself. Because I'm acting as if I'm still in that old life. And then at some point it's kind of, oh, Father, thank you for the grace that you've given me. And by faith, would you lay hold of my son? Fill him with your love. Transform my community. Thank you for your provision for my daily bread. I will trust you for that. Even though it looks like there's too much month and not enough money at the moment. Who cares? Because you're good. And your goodness is much greater than my current circumstances. You see, I live like the old life, still alive and well. It's sort of like the end of, you remember, what was that film? A really creepy film. But you've all watched it. Fatal Attraction. Fatal Attraction. That's the film. And what was the thing at Fatal Attraction? She just wouldn't die, would she? You're plang, not dead yet. Plang, not dead yet. And that's what happens to her old life. It's like Glenn Close in Fatal Attraction, because we keep bringing it back to life. We live as if that's true. And what Paul's saying is, no, actually, she was dead a long time ago. You're free from that. You're free from the charge of sin, which, if you're Michael Douglas in that film, was he needed free from that. I'll say no more. But if we died with the Messiah, we believe that we shall live with him. And we know that the Messiah, having been raised from the dead, will never die again. Death no longer has any authority over him. I'll just repeat that again. Death no longer has any authority over him. The death he died, you see, he died to sin once and once only. You see, not only did Jesus die, but he died in such a way, in a conspiracy with the Father and the Son, that he could deal with this law of sin and death, this rebellious thing, this turn back on God thing. He could deal with it so that when we trust in him, his labor on our behalf flows to us. And we're set free. It's just the most amazing thing. When we were praying for those young people to be filled with the Holy Spirit, that's what we were praying for. We were praying for the very life of God to be alive in them so that they would be alive to him, dead to sin, free to live the life of faith that God has for them. And did you notice that Paul says it's the Father's glory that raised Jesus from the dead, but the death he died to sin? And you see that, I mean, it's this, I keep wanting to do this, because as Jesus dies, he fulfills the law of sin and death, he deals with our rebellion, he deals with our brokenness and our sorrow, he deals with the evil of the Holocaust, he deals with the evils and the horrors that we see in Syria, he deals with all of that brokenness and nastiness and horribleness and wickedness, all the stuff that tends to death and destruction and darkness and horror and sickness and pain, and then he rises out from the grave with life and hope and joy and peace and recreative, miraculous, world-transforming wonder. I mean, that's what happened. And we get to go in there too. So we go into baptism recognizing that we ended up scruffy and broken and misguided and sinful. And we come back out glorious just like him. Calvin called it the divine exchange. You're not going to get this at cash converters, because they wouldn't even buy what you have to give them. And they don't have to sell what you get. It's just amazing. But the life he lives, this is Jesus, he lives to God in the same way you two must calculate yourselves as being dead to sin and alive to God in the Messiah Jesus. And just as when I first became a Christian, I was getting those notes, alive to God. Did anybody get those back in the day? Oh, the old SU notes, absolutely. I used to buy them as a sin offering because it made me look good. When I finally became a Christian, it kind of worked. Everything is set up in such a way as it's plausible to be an atheist. I know you don't think that if you trust in Jesus. You're like, really? But you can. But everything is also set up so that that moment where you start to put your trust in Jesus, the whole mechanics start working so that the me life gets to die and the Jesus life gets to live. And sometimes this is expressed in a way that the kind of, oh, me's bad, you know, I shouldn't buy myself nice clothes or whatever it may be, I was down on me, I'm a worm. So nothing could be further from the truth. The reason that the me life dies is because the me life cannot live with God. It's too selfish. That needs to die so that we can open up to the embrace of our Father in heaven. And that life is open and rich and giving and wonderful and is abundant. It's not a trip from, you know, scummy me to scummy me barely getting accepted. It's the love of the Father reaching out to us in Jesus that takes that old life that's killing us literally, puts it to death in the cross, and then as we trust in Him by faith, boom, the Father's glory raises us too. So let's have a wee look. Have you got that, by the way? So just say to your neighbor, you're fab, okay? Just as a, you're fab, okay? You're fab. Here I have, a little belatedly, because I'd run out. I like running out of baptismal certificates. There's something that I approve of in that. But I ran out, so I've got Liz and Chantel's and Chris's baptismal certificates here. You may or may not know that they were baptized, having done Alpha, on Christmas Day. It was one of my favorite memories of last year. And in baptism, because none of them had been baptized as children, because if they had, we'd have just gone, woohoo, it works. Which we do. None of them have been baptized, and we had three people from three different generations standing up here at the front to be baptized. It was just such a precious thing. But you see, baptism is the way that we're carried in through that process of saying, you know, because when I baptize an infant, they haven't sinned yet, okay? They will, but they haven't yet. And so what we're doing is we're working through that story with them and giving them that grace even before they really need it for that old selfish me life to die, the prideful thing to die, and for the life of Jesus to be risen in them. And the thing is that Paul, remember Paul's talking to Jewish and Gentile Christians here. He's talking to Jewish and non-Jewish Christians. He's trying to get them to work together, and he gets a bit sly because he starts to talk about things. I mean, you hear this thing about dying in baptism and stuff like that, and you're just thinking about baptism, right? That's because you're not Jewish. If you were Jewish and you were hearing this story, you would go back to those foundational stories of the Jewish people, and where might you be thinking? And by the way, once I've done this, you'll never look at baptism the same way again. Boom. Moses, the only boy of his generation to survive, brought up by Pharaoh's daughter because, you know, aww. I mean, chicken in a basket, that's good. But baby in a basket is irresistible. Gets brought up as one of Pharaoh's children, then discovers his true identity, kills an Egyptian guard, and flees at the age of 40. At the age of 80, God appears to him in a burning bush that isn't consumed. That's going to sound weird on the podcast. This is a Church of Scotland church. There's a picture of a burning bush somewhere, because there isn't every Church of Scotland church, because it's our symbol. And it says, Nec Tamen Consuma Batter. And now that there's no classics departments in any of the high schools, I have to explain to you that that means, but never consumed. It's on fire, but never consumed. Just like we as a church, as the Church of Scotland, is intended to be on fire, but never consumed. Are you getting faith? Pray that over the Church of Scotland. When you're next feeling like mumpa grumping your way through the latest news headlines, just say, Father, but never consume. Set the Church of Scotland on fire that it never be consumed. Which sounds a lot like John Wesley and God sets me on fire and people come to watch me burn. So he gets the call. He's resistant to that, but he eventually makes his way back. As a preacher once said, with a stick and a stutter. Stick that turns into a snake. Stick, snake, stutter, three S's. Our work is done here. And then he gets to Egypt and Pharaoh won't let the people go. And I know the Bible says that God hardens Pharaoh's heart. We could have a whole other sermon about that, but Pharaoh doesn't let them go. And the plagues ramp up and ramp up to the 10th plague of the Passover, which we now share as communion. And then they carry out the children of Israel into the desert, towards Mount Sinai, but the sea is in the way, and a Pharaoh has a change of heart yet again, and sends out the most technologically advanced army of his day. And just press pause. Never underestimate the ability of Almighty God to use for his purposes a leader who just seems no good. Unpause. And Pharaoh's armies pursue the children of Israel, and now they're in a pincer movement. There's mountains to the one side, mountains to the other side. They're on this plain between these two, well, this valley. The Red Sea's in front of them, the army's behind, they're about to be crushed. Now let's just think for a moment. Have you ever found yourself in that situation? Between the devil and the deep blue sea? Have you ever found yourself in a situation where you've got nowhere to turn? Where there's something needs to happen. God needs to do something because humanly speaking, you are in a pinch. And so the children of Israel find themselves in a situation just like this. And you can imagine the squeeze that's happening. And those of you being in a crowd will know how frightening that is when the crowd's constricting around about you. Moses has an option. Moses can either go with the people and go, oh, sack this. You've rescued us to just have us killed in the desert. And by the way, the children of Israel were Midlothian quality moaners. You ask the leader of the council how good Midlothian folk are at moaning. Now, they were fantastic at moaning. It's all down there in Exodus and Numbers. And so there's this great cry out from the people, oh, now you've rescued us out of Egypt, and now we're about to be killed. We're going to be drowned or slaughtered, you know, and our children are going to be slaughtered, and we'll be no more, and where's God's promises now? And Moses steps out with his staff, which he's seen turn into a snake, turned the Nile to blood. He's seen the frogs and the gnats and, you know, so on and so forth. And he walks to the edge of the water and he does what God tells him. He does what God tells him. And you wonder what was going on in his head. And he places the staff in the ground and what happens? There's a great wind and the waters are parted. Now, there's been big debates. Is it the Red Sea or the Reed Sea? Da, 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 da. Whatever it was a body of water substantial enough to drown the army. Because not only now we see the way through and the children of Israel are free and they start moving through, but as you'll know, they're about to be pursued if you've seen the Prince of Egypt or the Ten Commandments or whatever your favorite flavor of Moses is. I believe there's one on Netflix just now. Haven't seen it yet. So I can't recommend it or otherwise. They're making their way through. And they're making their way through, but they can hear the galloping behind them. And they realize, well, God's rescued them, but what's going to happen to the army? They're just going to be able to plow through and catch them up. And they get through to the other side, and what happens to the water? The waters close over the Egyptian army, and they cannot be pursued any longer. So just, you think about what that day was like being a Jewish kid. You see your parents get terrified. You look at the mayhem round about you. You can maybe see the glint of the bronze as they come over the top of the valley and down into the valley, and you think, this is it. We are in big trouble now. And people are, they're sort of saying, oh, we should never trust in Moses. We're better off staying back there, and now we're going to die. And the rising of fear and anger. And then God takes them through the waters. And a few hours later, Egypt has no army. And these people are free. And so they've changed from being fearful for their life to being delivered in the space of a day. When God inspired John the Baptist to go out into the wilderness and start baptizing people, you think they were thinking about this? He baptized them in the Jordan, which, by the way, at the other end of the story of their trip to the Promised Land, was also parted as the Ark of the Covenant was carried through. And there's this incredible thing where baptism symbolizes coming out of Egypt, which for the Jewish people was coming away from the place of suffering and difficulty and pagan nonsense and oppression and making their way through into that time in between to that desert land where it's not the job to get Israel out of Egypt. That's happened. They need to get the Egypt out of Israel. And so for 40 years, which is the length of a biblical generation, which symbolizes our life here, there's a contest going on. Are we going to trust? Are we going to trust that God will provide us with food in manna? Are we going to trust that God's going to provide us with meat in quail, water from the rock? He's going to look after these enemies. How's he going to show us? Was a cloud of fire by day, fire by night and cloud by day? And as they go through the desert wilderness, they're being prepared to take the promised land. Does it remind you of anyone? So in baptism, we're removed from our state of sinfulness into this reign of grace, but we can barely lay hold of it because we're not too sure. We're not too sure that God's really for us. We swither, even though it's all ours. We swither and we try this, we try that, we doubt this, we doubt that. And then when we find out bit by bit by bit that God is faithful, we are released to live in the reality of his love. And by faith, we grow and grow to the point where the love of Jesus is so a work in our lives, it overflows to other people, just like overfilling a cup of water. And we can give out to other people what we've received, and we become a change agent in our street. The glory of God flows into the community round about us. Ooh. And here's the cool thing. As we start to open up Hope Springs, which would be some kind of Christian wellness center, we just put ourselves on the alternative therapy label at the GP surgery. And when a GP's going, I don't know what to do with this person, here's a list of things you can try, we're going to be on there. And we can ask for people to get that. We've already had our first referral from a GP. I'm not going to tell you who it was, but all right, okay. He went back to the GP and said, it's great, found Jesus, going along to church now. And the GP said, I just thought you might want to go along for a week. Brilliant. Does that make sense?